There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, so glad that you could join me for a little classic cardboard conversation. And we do have some classic cardboard to talk about this week, and a little bit of controversy over it, not from the original set itself, but honestly from some statements that I made about the set. When we first looked at it a long time ago. No, actually, it wasn't extremely that long ago. However, 2017 does seem to be like an eternity ago, doesn't it? Hell, February and March sound like an eternity ago. No, let's go back to April 18th, 2017. We looked back at the 1961 Topps set. And if you go back through our archives, you'll see that we called the program Topps Keeps It Common in 1961. And the episode description says, host Matt Salmon looks back at the plain 1961 Topps set and why Topps had to hold back on card design that season. And, well, that's the truth. Topps had to hold back on an elaborate card design. And we'll discuss that. But we had some listeners over the years take umbrage to my declaration that 61 Topps was plain. And I think what's really important to differentiate here is plain does not necessarily mean boring. And it certainly doesn't mean it's bad. Plain just means without much fanfare. Or you could say simple. And it's just funny when people look at something. Simple often is the artistic, glorious way of saying, wow, this is amazingly clean. But if you say plain, well, plain becomes boring. It becomes vanilla. And vanilla, especially like vanilla ice cream, is actually quite tasty, even if you don't put anything on it. But vanilla looks slightly less appealing than mint chocolate chip. But it's all subjective. And 1961 Topps is a very subjective set when it comes to describing it. And let's take a little detour here as we talk about simple and clean and boring and vanilla. Let's talk hockey sweaters just for a moment. Or as the non-hockey fans would call them, hockey jerseys. If you're not Canadian, you probably call them hockey jerseys. The purists call them sweaters, even though they've become less and less sweater-like over the last 40 or 50 years. But anyways, a former employer of mine, the Tampa Bay Lightning, back in 2011, unveiled a new jersey scheme. Brand new logo, brand new color palette, a whole new look to a hockey brand that had been relatively untouched for the previous 20 years. When the Lightning started in the early 1990s, like every sports team in the early 1990s, black was the team's primary color, as well as a mix of silver and blue. You had a rather innocent, almost cheap-looking logo that was affixed to the jersey. But that jersey was much loved by Lightning fans because after years of being the doormat of the NHL, that was the jersey that the team hoisted the Stanley Cup with in 2004. There was a remake of the jersey in 2007, a little more modernized look to it. Yeah, the colors were the same, but, you know, every logo, when it gets modernized, it just has a few more sharp edges added to it, and that's essentially what happened. But when they rolled out this 2011 jersey, first of all, the primary color was this deep, dark, royal blue. And it had this almost Flash Gordon Lightning logo to it. And the home sweater didn't have any word mark on it. It was just that lightning bolt in a circle, this white logo on top of a blue sweater. Very, very simple. Clean. Hockey purists said, oh, this looks just like the Detroit Red Wings, which was appropriate since Steve Yzerman, Red Wing great, was the general manager of the team at the time. Or hockey purists said, this looks just like the Toronto Maple Leafs, which actually became a problem when the Toronto Maple Leafs came into Tampa Bay. It was hard to tell which team was which because the jerseys looked so much alike. But then you had the people that didn't see it as simple and clean. They saw it boring, or they mocked it for looking like a comic book. Or you had the people that were really nitpicky about it and said, wait a minute, where is the black on my jersey? I've always had black. I must have black. And to the Lightning management and ownership's credit, they said, okay, we'll give you a little bit of black. So the numbers and the logo, everything received a thin black outline. Third jerseys that were created in future years had black as their primary color. And while there was a lot of uncertainty and questions about this new clean or was it boring design, and that is kind of the same attitude you get from people that look at 1961 Topps. You will have the people that look at the lack of logos, the lack of facsimile autographs, the lack of really any color, the devotion to the picture on the front. People will go, oh, that's clean. That's simple. That's just like 1957 Topps or the holy grail of post-war baseball cards, 1953 Bowman. And then you'll have others, including myself, who'll go, yeah, it's simple, it's clean, but it's a little plain. And some people don't like hearing that. And that's okay, because as long as we're living in a country with freedom of speech, well, we still are, at last check, it's okay to have an opinion that is different from others. And it's okay if you think 61 Topps is a little dull. It's also okay to think that 61 Topps is a work of art. And it is perfectly okay to kind of go right down the middle and go, yeah, it's not as flashy as some of the sets right before or right after it, but it's still pretty darn good. And I'm of that third option. I kind of go down the middle. You know, hey, I'm an independent, you know? So... yeah, you know, that's my two cents on that. But we'll get into the details of the 61 Topps set, why Topps had to keep it simple, why they had to play it safe, some of the difficulties in the 61 Topps set, and there were a lot of them, and how the set survives to this day, despite maybe not being a work of art in sense of, you know, 56 Topps or maybe 65 Topps, you know, some other sets that get a little more love and attention than the 61 Topps set gets. And we'll get to that in a moment. First, a little housekeeping, as we always like to do here. We come your way every other Friday. So today is September the 25th. Our next show will be coming up right around the bend, October 9th. We're going to be taking a look then at the minor league baseball cards. When minor league baseball cards were no longer fun, yes, the classic best 1993 minor league baseball cards set. Now, I say tongue-in-cheek that the minor league cards were no longer fun because as a collector, I still enjoyed collecting minor league cards. And there were certainly plenty of fun chase cards, including autographed Mike Schmidt cards showcasing some of his days in the minor leagues in the late 60s and early 70s. But, you know, it became a chore getting minor league cards because what started as just a little fun project from the TCMA people in the mid-70s grew into a bloated branch of the hobby, much like a lot of things did in the early 1990s. So we'll talk 1993 classic best AAA cards in our next podcast. And then on deck, October 23rd, we're looking at a unique combination of items. We'll be looking at 1987 Donruss All-Star Pop-Up cards and the 1979 Topps Chewing Gum All-Star Wrappers. And again, if you haven't heard the description of what the All-Star Wrappers were, no, it was not Melly Mel. It was not Grandmaster Flash, although they are certainly worthy of such an honor. No, we're talking wrappers with a W. That would be gum wrappers, where Topps, as they continuously tried to push Topps branded bubblegum, even though it was basically Bazooka Joe bubblegum, even though they tried to push the Topps brand about 40 years ago, and they came up with this ingenious way of promoting baseball as well, wrapping the gum in these all-star comics about particular players. For whatever reason, it was deemed unsuccessful, never caught on, and in fact only lasted 1 year. So we will unwrap some 41-year-old pieces of bubblegum and take a gander at some of the all-star wrappers. So that is what is on deck for the next couple of shows. Now, you can always talk to us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. Always appreciate the conversation from fans. We always take show suggestions and requests as well, or questions that you may have. So you can post those again at Wax and Gum Stains at any time. And please do share that Twitter handle with your card collecting friends, even if they don't collect today. If they collect back in the day, that's always a fun thing to discuss as well. Also, if you have the capability to make a donation to Wax Ecstatic, we certainly appreciate that. We've been running free of charge for over 4 years now, so you're welcome to make a donation in one of two ways. You can make a cash donation. That's easy. PayPal.me/Wax Ecstatic. Wax Ecstatic, all one word there. Again, PayPal.me/Wax Ecstatic. Even if it's just $5, $8, you know, something in the single digits. We'll greatly appreciate any cash donations, as that goes right back into the show. One, maintaining our presence at Audio Boom and keeping our archives free, 100% free. That's something we don't have to do, but we like to do it. So that's one way that your money goes to the program. Also, it helps us purchase the products that we discuss on this show and any excess product we have, especially if we open up a box of cards or, you know, several packs of cards we may have some left over. We will donate those to Commons for Kids, which you can follow at Commons4, that's the number 4 kids, on Twitter, as we are able to pass along cards, not just of vintage days, not only from wax junk wax days, but also some current cards as well. We'll donate those to Commons for Kids, who then in turn donate those to kids who are having tough times these days, whether they're dealing with economic issues, problems at home, or in many cases, medical issues. And nothing brightens up a child's day than giving them something fun to play with, something to get their mind off whatever is hurting them or stressing them out at a particular point in time. And it's a great way also to grow the hobby and to keep kids connected to baseball by connecting them with some of their favorite players and maybe their favorite teams. So that's where the cash donations go. Also, cardboard donations. Again, if you're cleaning out your closets, you've found some old filler cards, or maybe you've heard me complain about being 30 cards shy of finishing a set that I'm working on. You can make a cardboard donation as well. Just email me what you plan on sending before you actually send it to Matt Salmon Says, that's S-E-Z, at gmail.com. And we'll get a little dialogue going, just making sure that you're not going to just dump a bunch of cards on me. We will, you know, in turn, turn over cards to Commons for Kids if we just suddenly get this large lot of cards. But we certainly want to coordinate it. We don't want you spending $20-25 on shipping if it's something that, you know, we can't really use or discuss on the program. So kind of keep that in mind. Now, one other quick note before we talk about 61 Tops, that is, you may notice an awful lot of interesting noises throughout this particular show. You may have heard a school bus in the background. That means my son's home. And you're going to hear other noises as well. Maybe the wind picking up, maybe my pool vacuum coming to surface and sucking up way too much air before resetting. The reason why you're hearing all this is I'm opting to actually record today's show outside. And this is how just ridiculous Floridians are. It is only 87 degrees in September, but it is also only 48% humidity. So when you live in Florida, 87 degrees at 48% humidity feels like it's 60. At least mentally, it feels like it's 60. In reality, you know, the heat index is like 89. But, you know, it's not 95. You know, during the summer, we have heat indices up, you know, in the 110 range. So it's a beautiful day. And much like I did for a couple of shows earlier this year, or earlier, maybe late last year, so like in November, I think I opened the windows in my studio. And of course, you heard a lot of the noise in the street outside my home here. But, you know, I take advantage of these beautiful days here. And again, it's only 87, but I'm not schwitzing like crazy on my back patio here. So forgive the noise. It's all natural. It may be a little disturbing, but it's just a pleasant environment to sit in and do the program. You may also hear cicadas very loudly in the background, too. That's another quote-unquote plus of living in Florida, the strange insects and other creatures that live in the woods that are extremely noisy. So bear with me, but enjoy the sounds of nature, too, while we talk about the rather natural-looking 61 top set. And let's dive into the 61 top set. First of all, let's get into just the basics of the set. In 1961, it was the largest set that Topps had made at that time. 587 cards, although the checklist will say 588. We'll get into that in just a little bit. But one reason why it was suddenly 587 cards, and at the time the largest set that Topps produced, was simple. The 1961 expansion in Major League Baseball. Now, that would play a huge part in Topps' decisions to keep it simple, which we'll get into as well. But again, 587 cards. And it should be noted that while the 587 cards were split up over seven series, for whatever reason, the first, I'd say, four series were produced in much larger numbers than the remaining three or four series. Now, I say for whatever reason. Well, we know what that reason is. If you've listened to the show, I've given you the history of how Topps used to handle things in terms of releasing of series. And it was simple. By 1961, Topps had just gotten into the habit of mass producing series 3, series 4 in rather large numbers, but then dialing back on the production of series 5, 6, and 7 because football season was coming around, summer was ending, you know, as these later high number series came out. But also in some cases, you would have retailers who maybe weren't having that much luck unloading some of the earlier series. So if they were having trouble selling series 1, 2, and 3, and they had a bunch sitting in a warehouse, they wouldn't order wholesale from Topps the higher series cards. So with Topps not wanting to have cases and cases of high series cards sitting in their warehouses in Brooklyn, they would just scale back production and not have a whole lot of time, effort, and certainly money go to waste. That was a lesson of 52 Topps. As the story is well known, Cy Berger and the Topps executives not wanting to have tens of thousands of 52 Topps cards languishing in a warehouse, dump them into the Atlantic Ocean, which brings many a tear to a lot of collectors' eyes. So rather than just polluting the world's oceans with a Juan Marichal rookie card, by 1961, they decided to just simply cut production. And that, of course, creates a long-term shortage. So getting those high series cards after card number 370 is a bit of a task. Now, if you do go combing through the bargain bin boxes, perhaps not at a PSA 10, but at a relatively decent price, you can find some great rookie cards in the 61 set, including Juan Marichal, also Ron Santo, Billy Williams, all three of those Hall of Famers. And, of course, you've got a lot of early career cards. The Carl Yastrzemski card, that's his second Topps card, but it's very popular for collectors because it doesn't have the graphics, the all-rookie team sporting news look that kind of swallowed up his 1960 rookie card. So it's a little more of a cleaner rookie card. Or boring, if you prefer. But you also have, you know, a lot of young stars, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, Brooks Robinson, Harmon Killebrew, you name it. All the big stars of the late 50s and early 60s are prominently featured in this 1961 set. And no stars bigger than what you got in Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris. Now, we'll bring up Mantle and Maris in a moment, but let's talk a little bit more about the set here. Now, part of what makes collecting the 61 top set so difficult, other than the short, I don't want to say short prints, but the shortage of cards from the high series, of course, is condition. You had still some quality control issues with Topps in the early 60s, so you often find cards that are slightly off-center or maybe have ink issues. But often the condition issues you have is in 1961, people didn't treat these as collectibles. They were toys. They were hobby pieces. So you not only have the traditional baseball cards in bicycle tire spokes stories here, but you also have cards that were flipped. You have cards that were held together by rubber bands. You also have cards that were, you know, stuffed away in shoe boxes, not exactly treated with kid gloves, much like people started treating those cards as early as the early 1970s. So if you are looking for card number one, Dick Grote, a hero of the 1960 World Series for the Pittsburgh Pirates, it's pretty beaten up, as well as quite a few of those low number cards, including that Roger Maris card. Now, we also have a lot of subsets throughout this set. You've got your annual league leaders. You also have World Series highlights. Also, manager cards are grouped together in a subset, if you will. So if you enjoy the dreaded manager card, you can find that in the lower series. But once you get into the high series, you have the baseball thrills. You have MVP cards, which go through the 1950s MVPs. So you not only have hard-to-find high series cards, but certainly star players. So there's added value to that. And, oh, by the way, you've got your sporting news, all-star cards, and a lot of star power there as well. So it's not just the shortage of cards or the problems with conditioning of cards. When you have a shortage of high-quality condition cards featuring many Hall of Famers and All-Stars of the time, these cards obviously command a premium. Now, there are also some interesting snafus with the 1961 set as well. Like I said, the set is actually at 587 cards. However, there is on a checklist card, it is listed that there is a card number 588, which is not actually the case. Also, one of the checklists point out that, or in fact, there are three versions of a checklist, I should say, card number 98, where it shows that there is supposed to be a card number 426, which is supposed to be the Milwaukee Braves team card. Well, Topps somehow managed to put both the Milwaukee Braves team card and Jack Fisher's card listed as card number 463. So the Braves team checklist says 463, when in reality it was supposed to be 426. So technically there is no card number 426. So you not only have three different versions of a checklist on card number 98, but you also have one less card that is advertised, and then through an error, one fewer card, because technically there is no card number 426. So there can be some confusion if you're not educated on what is actually inside the 61 top set when you try to put that together. Now, if you're also somebody who considers a complete set truly complete, once you add all of the bells and whistles, and that includes inserts, that's very difficult with any top set in the 1960s because there were a lot of inserts. And I'm not talking about cards. I'm talking about bonus goodies. And in 1961, that was the Topps baseball stamps. Now, you not only had green stamps or brown stamps, but you also had 208 total options in these stamps. And some stamps feature players in both colors, including Al Kaline. You also had temporary tattoos, which were called magic rub-offs, that were available in Series 1 packs. So you've got 36 of those temporary tattoos. So if you're somebody who sees the complete set as only including everything that you would have pulled out of your wax pack back in the day, good luck trying to pull together not only 587 cards in the entire seven series of the set, but also 244 inserts, be it stamps or temporary tattoos. And those, of course, are very difficult to find in good condition, simply because the stamps were often throwaway items for a lot of kids, but also the tattoos, well, most kids actually stuck them on their body, or maybe they rubbed them off on a book or a piece of furniture or something like that. So trying to find one in mint condition is just damn near impossible. But if you're going through maybe an estate sale, or you somehow find a few thousand dollars to drop on a 1 cent pack of 61 tops that has been unopened, that is what you will find inside. Now let's talk about the star power of Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle. As I pointed out, there was a subset within the set called Baseball Thrills. And Baseball Thrills was a 11-card set that featured just a lot of baseball highlights from the previous 60 years of the modern day edition of Major League Baseball, that is the National League and American League. And one of the highlights, in fact, the first highlight, card number 401, features Babe Ruth slamming his 60th home run. Now, call Topps rather predictive, or maybe they were just lucky in this instance here. But of course, 1961, the season of the asterisk, as some people will call it, was also the season of the M&M boys, Mantle and Maris. And of course, if you know anything about baseball history, Roger Maris not only surpassed that 60 home run mark, he did so with 61 home runs. It was often debated if that was a legit record because he did it in the expanded 162 game season in the American League, something the league had to do by adding two new teams to balance the schedule out, where the Babe did that in 154 games in 1927. So, of course, the commissioner of baseball, Ford Frick, being a big fan of the Yankee legend in Babe Ruth, puts an asterisk alongside 61, and that would remain an albatross, not only on the record, but certainly on Roger Maris's life for many, many years. And the accomplishments of Roger Maris and how hard it is to hit 61 home runs, yes, even if there are eight more games on the schedule, yes, even if there are two expansion teams, and that kind of waters down certainly the pitching pool in the American League that year, it is still very difficult to hit 61 home runs, even if Mickey Mantle is providing cover for you in the lineup, although Mantle was dealing with a lot of injuries in 1961. That's a big reason why he did not break the mantle, or at least did not break the record, or at least did not, you know, overachieve and beat Maris in the final home run tally of the 1961 season. So people came about to really recognizing how hard it was to beat or hit 61 home runs in a couple of stages. One, the great Billy Crystal produced film, 61, which was released back in 2001, was rather, a poignant look back at Maris and all the crap that he faced during that season and afterwards, too. Of course, Billy Crystal, a huge Yankee fan, so, this storyline was right up his alley. But also, I think a lot of people took the Maris story to heart in the summer of 61, or the season of 61 to heart, because when 61 came out, we were right in the thick, no pun intended, of the steroid era. And Crystal, of course, acknowledged Mark McGwire surpassing Roger Maris's 61 home runs in the 1998 season with 62. Of course, McGwire would have 70 at the end of the season. But in the 2001 season, of course, Barry Bonds would surpass McGwire with 73 home runs. And I think a lot of people took the Maris story with much more empathy because, or sympathy, I don't know what the right word is there. I think they took that a little more inwardly, with a little more feeling, because even though the McGwire and Sosa race to 61 home runs, really just grabbed the nation's attention in 1998 and certainly revived the interest in Major League Baseball after the strike of 1994, there was still some doubt. Like, people are looking at Mark McGwire, people are looking at Sammy Sosa going, these guys are a little more muscular than they used to be. Is this the same Mark McGwire that was hitting like 215 in 1992? What's going on here? But, people got caught up in the hype. And there was still the tie-in, like McGwire still very much involved, the Maris family, of course, being with the St. Louis Cardinals, which was Maris's last team. And, Maris, opened up some Budweiser breweries or managed them, some canning plants after his playing days. There was a nice St. Louis connection there and the Anheuser-Busch connection as well. And, there are all sorts of interesting storylines there. But then Bonds comes along, and there's no doubt that Bonds is using steroids. And let's be honest, too, there is a racist undertone to where a lot of people could get caught up in Big Mac, but clearly Barry Bonds is a criminal here. And Bonds has that ridiculous 2001 season where he has 73 home runs. And of course, eventually, 6 years afterwards, he surpasses Hank Aaron's career home run number. And that's why I think a lot of people come back to realize, well, hey, even if you think Roger Maris had an advantage of having Mantle protect him in the lineup, having some watered-down pitching league-wide because of the new Washington Senators and LA Angels. And yeah, Wrigley Field in Los Angeles was a bandbox. And yeah, there were eight more games to the schedule. You can come up with all sorts of excuses, but at the same time you're going, this was an average built human being who had tremendous hand-eye coordination and power who just had one magical season. And I think a lot of people started to realize that, roughly 20 years ago. And I think a lot of people have a new appreciation for the Maris and Mantle race that was going on back in 1961. So if you're able to get your hands on a 1961 Topps Roger Maris or Mickey Mantle card, there is added value to it. Even if it's a thoroughly beaten up card that you buy for $5 in a bargain bin at a show, it's one of the M&M boys from 1961. And it is an extremely relevant piece of history in a rather historic time and a disputed record that was not surpassed for 27 years. But even since then, people look back at it and go, well, the legitimate home run record is more on Roger Maris because we're presuming that, he was doing it cleanly. So you have that piece of history that's there. Also, a big history piece with the 1961 Topps set is the expansion. And that is one reason why Topps had to keep the card design very simple, and one reason why they did not include team logos, which they did in the 58, 59, and 60 sets. And that's simply because, first of all, when it came to the new Washington Senators and the Los Angeles Angels, Topps had no idea, as they're starting to put this set into production in November and December of 1960, they have no idea what these teams are going to look like. And it's not just in logos and uniforms and team colors, but also the team. You know, the expansion draft happens late in 1960, and that's essentially all Topps has to work with going into the production of the 1961 set. Now, Topps would be able to catch a break with some of those higher series sets, because by then, they are able to send out photographers to the spring training sites of the Senators and the Angels, also the Minnesota Twins, so the relocated first version of the Senators. And again, they have no idea what the Twins, they probably didn't even know what the Twins' name was going to be, because Minneapolis and St. Paul, both cities, had a rich history of minor league baseball, and the Twins were playing in Bloomington, so you're in a suburb of Minneapolis. So were you going to call the team the Minneapolis Millers? Were you going to call them the St. Paul Saints? Or were you going to split it down the middle and go, all right, we're going to include Minneapolis and St. Paul and just give the team a statewide name? So the Minnesota Twins. And that's why their caps, and I'm so glad they went back to the original logo on the cap, the T and the C, if you didn't know, stands for Twin Cities. So Topps had no idea what the Twins were going to look like, much less be named. They didn't know what the Senators were going to look like. They didn't know what the Angels were going to look like. So they were able to make up for that with spring training photos of a lot of these players in some of the higher series. But when the series rolls out in the spring of 1961, you've got to have something. So working with the expansion draft list, working with whatever photographs of players, sans hat, or the ever famous, you know, below the chin picture of players, so you can't see the top of their hat. Topps would occasionally pull out the airbrush kit and just blurt out the logo of the old team. You'll see plenty of Angels and Senators and Twins who are clearly wearing uniforms that were once the Phillies or the Braves or the Yankees, but they had to close crop them to kind of make that good. So with the inability to showcase a logo or to showcase a uniform, Topps had to keep it very simple. And in that way of keeping things simple in the design, just because of just the situation, they couldn't really show much. That is why the overall design of the set is the way it is. Now, again, some people will call it plain, which I think it is plain, but I think there are elements of simplicity and cleanliness to it. There's also a slight element of boring to it when you look in context, and we have the greatness of being able to look back in context now almost 60 years later. We can look back at those sets from 58, 59, and 60 and see the Madison Avenue work that was into these complete productions. The stripped down look in 1961, even the wood grain, you know, wanted poster look of the 62 set, which a lot of fans love, had to be simple because you had the Mets and the Colt 45s that year. So, you know, Topps still had to keep it relatively simple, but still it was a step up from, in terms of creativity, from the simplicity of 61. So you look at the following set, 62, 63, 64, 65. When you look at the stretch of sets from 1958 to 1965, so we've got 9 years of sets there. When you look at them and you say, tell me which one is the most creative or the most artistic. Yes, you're going to have some people who see creative and artistic as simple and clean, and they'll point to 61. But you'll also have people who are looking for a little more razzmatazz to it, and they'll go, oh, I like, you know, the 59 set, or I like the 65 set, or 63. And that's okay. You know, this is the beauty of the hobby. There's no wrong way to collect, but also there's no wrong way to look at it. Just like I started the show with comparing uniform and logo unveils for the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Dallas Stars many years ago, you could look at it and go, it's great, or it sucks. It's just like any work of art in any art gallery. And go to an art gallery, look at any painting, and judge for yourself what some people call a tremendous work of art. You may look at it and go, what is this? Or the other way around, people may look at something and go, what is this? And you may say, well, I really appreciate, you know, the colors or the design or, you know, whatever. Or, you know, it's kind of like a Rorschach test. You see something in the painting that maybe other people don't see. So I think there's that same vibe with 61 Tops. To each his own. You can see simplicity. You can see cleanliness. You can see, you know, the beauty of something that looks a lot like 57 Tops or 53 Bowman or some of the TCMA major league sets that were produced in the mid 70s. Or you may go, well, I'm a big fan of, you know, the more colorful sets like 56 Tops or, you know, some of the sets from the later 60s or the early 70s. And, you know, I'm not crazy about it. That's okay. You know, it's very much like 88 Tops. It's very much like, you know, 81 Tops too. And that was actually interesting. You know, one of the people that brought up aesthetics in 61 Tops tried to compare it to 81 Tops. And is 81 Tops like 61 Tops? There are some similarities, but no, yeah, I of course give the edge to 61 Tops. But, you know, you may like a certain look and feel. I just think in 1961, Tops had to play it safe because they just didn't know what was happening, not just with one team, not just with two teams, but three teams. And, you know, nowadays, when a team is going to rebrand and introduce a new logo or a new cap, there's all sorts of fanfare. Look at the San Diego Padres. The San Diego Padres are the best example of a baseball team stretching out the eventual shift to a new look. And the Padres, going back 4 or 5 years, started reintroducing on special occasions, you know, whether it was the anniversary of the team's founding in 1969, or maybe it was the anniversary of the 84 World Series team or whatever, you would have the brown and gold kind of sneak back in. It was very prominent during the All-Star game back in, what was it, 2017, where, you know, the brown and the gold was part of the National League and American League uniform. And it was very much a playoff of the early 80s Padres unis. But still, the Padres stuck with the navy blue. They stuck with some kind of blue and orange combination. They stuck with the various camouflage jerseys as they're, you know, very big on honoring the military in San Diego. And despite occasionally releasing the Kraken here to, you know, satisfy the needs of Padres fans who wanted to bring back the brown and gold, even management of the Padres was deriding it. It's just like, we're not going to let poop brown come back into the lexicon. Well, finally, I think the Padres did enough research to realize, all right, well, it may look like poop brown, but the fans dig it. And all of a sudden now you've got these variations of the brown and gold that have come back and look great. Sure, it's not an exact replica of what they introduced in 1969 or what they wore in the World Series in 1984 or the late 80s Tony Gwynn's or the mid-70s garish gold primary colors of Randy Jones and Dave Winfield. But that's okay. You know, they found a way to incorporate these colors that people like. But to my point, this dragged on for a good 4 or 5 years, these little teases, yet the team just didn't want to embrace it. Finally, they embrace it, and you just have this big production of, you know, here's our new design. And you see teams do that over and over. Back in 1961, that was not the case. You often were not aware of a team's new uniform or logo or colors maybe until spring training, and sometimes not until opening day, because teams either didn't have the financial capacity to purchase those new uniforms in spring training, or they wanted to get one more use out of those old jerseys in spring training before ultimately dropping them down on some AA or AAA affiliate of theirs that happened to share the same name. Case in point, when the Chicago White Sox introduced the kind of throwback uniforms in 1976, you know, the dark blue and white collared jerseys, the ones that featured shorts as an alternative, the old red and white pinstripe ones very quickly ended up in Knoxville, their AA affiliate, because the Knoxville team was called the Sox. So they were able to get a little extra mileage out of some of those early 70s uniforms. But I digress. So that, in a nutshell, is 61 Tops. And there's a lot of great things about 61 Tops. Again, the rookie selection. You've got three Hall of Famers that jump out in Williams, Marichal, and Santo. You've got a lot of young stars. You know, the Yaz second-year card. You've got Mantle. You've got Mays. You've got Aaron. You've got Roger Maris. You've got Warren Spahn and Sandy Koufax. I mean, you name it. There's just so many great ball players from, you know, the late 1950s that are present in the 1961 set. You've got a lot of interesting subsets that are loaded with star power that are hard to find because of printing cutbacks later on in the series. And you've got all sorts of wild and crazy inserts, which if you're able to actually get your hands on them, then you found yourself a treasure. So despite the fact that the 61 top set may lack a little bit in some of the aesthetics of other cards, still, you have to take a look at the set as a whole. And is it plain? Yes, it's a plain set. And that's okay. Again, nothing wrong with vanilla ice cream, even without sprinkles or chocolate syrup or whatever. It's just easy to get distracted by the Rocky Road or the mint chocolate chip. So if there is a plainness seen in 61 Tops, that is your own subjective opinion on it, much like you may think it's simple and clean and a work of art. But even if you deem it plain, you can't deem it as a bad set. This is not 91 Fleer or 82 Fleer. This is not 90 Donruss or 81 Donruss. This is not, you know, a clunky set. You know, you can detract on 82 Tops. You can pinpoint all sorts of, you know, even in 69 Tops. It's not there. There's a simplicity to it, yes. There's a little plainness to it, yes. But is there anything bad about 61 Tops? Absolutely not. So if I were to declare 61 Tops as good but not great, don't take that as an insult. Take it as my opinion. If you think it's a great set, you think it's a great set. Me? Not so much. But it is not a bad set. It is not a terrible set. It is not a forgettable set. It is not one that needs to be vanquished to the depths of history. No, it was a very cautious set. It had to be. But it's loaded with stars. It's loaded with rookies. If you're a fan of the Twins or the Angels or the Nationals / Rangers / Senators, you know, trying to, you know, tie in the Washington roots and then, of course, you know, the second Senators team moving to Texas in 1972. The 1961 top set is a unique and fun set for you. And I think it's one of those sets that if you're able to pick up some commons on the cheap, or like I said, if you're able to find a, maybe it's a PSA 4 Maris or Mantle card. You know, I know my off-centered Willie McCovey card is not worth, you know, the thousands of dollars you could get for it if it was PSA 10. But it's Willie McCovey. It's stretch. 61 Tops. Looking pretty good. So don't denigrate the 61 Tops set, even if it's deemed plain by one's imagination. Plain is not a bad thing. Call it simple, call it clean. Plain is not a bad thing. Even if you think it's a little boring compared to other sets from around that time, it is not a bad set. So regardless of how you think the aesthetics play into it, it's not a bad set. Now, one last thing about aesthetics I will put out there. Aesthetics are extremely important in any product. You know, obviously the product that you're selling has to look good, but it also has to work, and the consumer has to enjoy it. So does 61 Tops work? Well, yeah, it's got all the stars, all the rookies, all the big moments in baseball history. Yeah, it's right there. Does the consumer enjoy it? Yeah, it's a very popular set. Does it look great? Could be better. But aesthetics is very important, and that is why a company like Topps spends so much time on designing the right type of card. That is also why baseball teams or hockey teams or whatever spend a lot of time determining what their team color palette should be, what the logo should look like, what the uniform should look like. I mean, it's beyond ridiculous these days. We now have uniform schedules. Hey, if you want to coordinate your clothes to what the team is wearing today, here's what we're wearing. So, you know, I think it goes beyond the point of ridiculous if you have to have a uniform schedule. You have to tell people this is what we're wearing. The Yankees don't do that. Alabama football doesn't do that. But, you know, other teams in various sports, they do. They have to tell you which color pants we're wearing today because some people are just crazy about that. So don't ignore aesthetics because it plays a very important part not only in sports and fanaticism in sports today, but it did 60 years ago when Topps was all Madison Avenue with some of their sets in the late 50s and 1960, but out of necessity had to simplify it in 1961 and again in 62, although with a slight wood grain finish. Now, I mentioned stretch. Yes, Willie McCovey is one of the cards that we're going to look at, one of the players we look at here. And I've mentioned before that my 1961 Topps collection has grown over the years, although not quite to the extent that I thought it had grown. I think I only had maybe two cards in the 61 set a few years ago when I was doing the original show. I've grown that to, I believe, seven now. I'm sure I have some in a collection. I've had some listeners send me a lot of beat up cards from the late 50s and early 60s recently, and I just haven't organized them yet, or at least I haven't put them in the binder sheets like I did with some of these other 61 Topps cards. But I have added to the set. But since we looked at Ted Bowersfield in our original 1961 Topps episode, and since two of the 1961 Topps cards I have are team cards, we have a Milwaukee Braves pitchers card and a Cincinnati Redlegs hitters card, I wanted to take a look at the other five cards that we have. So let me do the math there. That's actually eight cards. Okay, so I've got eight cards here. So let's take a look at the other cards that we do have. And there are a couple of notable players that are in there, including Willie McCovey and, of course, Duke Snider. But the other three players you may not know much about, but I've got a couple of interesting stories in them. So one of the cards is a card that features the trophy, the Topps All-Rookie Trophy. Yes, the same trophy that graces the Ron Santo Hall of Famer rookie card, also graces the Jim Coker card. Now, it's not his rookie card. He actually had a card in the 1960s set, but it was deemed by Topps that Jimmy Coker would be a star. Let's put that trophy on his card, and why not? Thanks to our good friend here, David Skelton, at the Society for American Baseball Research, he points out that the Sporting News, after the 1959 minor league seasons, deemed that Jimmy Coker was such a good catcher. He was, and I quote, the top catcher produced in the International League since Roy Campanella graduated from the Montreal Royals. And Cy Kritzer predicted in the baseball Bible, not just that, but the manager of the Buffalo Bisons, which was Jim Coker's team in 1959, Kirby Ferrell predicted that Coker would be the best catcher in the National League. Yikes. Whoo, boy. So much like in our last show, we talked about how, you know, you could get a blessing and a curse from Sparky Anderson declaring you're the best infielder on the team when you got Lou Whitaker and Alan Trammell in the way. Having the sporting news, then the Bible of baseball, declaring you to be the best catcher in the National League since Roy Campanella, and your minor league manager going, he's going to be the best in the National League. Sadly for Jim Coker, this definitely set him up to fail. Now, it's not necessarily Jim Coker's fault, as we'll find out. He just had the misfortune of being on some terrible teams. A native of Holly Hill, South Carolina, a very tiny town northwest of Charleston, the Coker family had set roots in there for a couple of centuries. Jimmy Coker, born in March of 1936, a star at Holly Hill High School, where he was not only a baseball star, but also basketball and football. In fact, he earned an All-State Honor Award and an athletic scholarship to Furman University in nearby Greenville, South Carolina. As a football player, he was going to be a fullback, but he suffered a shoulder injury in his freshman year, so he decided it was time to move away from football and move on to baseball. And early on, he felt that even though he had that football scholarship and he was very good at the sport, ever since a child, he dreamed of being a Major League Baseball player. So roughly when he makes this decision, he gets signed by the Philadelphia Phillies and he starts moving up the Phillies organization. Now, even though he had a pretty good arm in terms of strength and was also decent at the plate, defensively, he was not a very solid catcher, as he committed quite a few errors in the minor league, and that is something that would come back in the major leagues as well. And that did not help him out in any stretch of the imagination. Now, as he's working his way up through the minor leagues, he has a very promising debut in September of 1958 as the Phillies are taking on the Los Angeles Dodgers. He gets his first major league hit off of Johnny Podres. Not a bad guy to get that first hit off of. And he would actually, you know, have some moments of greatness in his cup of coffee in the 1958 season. Now, unfortunately, he was also in the Air Force Reserve, so he would have to split time. And in fact, a lot of baseball players at the time were doing this. He would have to split time between the minor leagues and the reserves, as the case was. So trying to stay in the spotlight in Philadelphia's system, as well as being part of the Air Force, occupied much of his time in 1959. He did get some time in the major leagues, but struggled throughout the season. And then he starts running into the logjam as you head into 1960. The Phillies started to have a whole bunch of catchers in the pipeline here. And even though Coker had a lot of upside, shall we say, a lot of potential, which is a very dirty word for some players, he just could not break through from the pack. And of course, the Phillies were a bad team. Poor Gene Mauch, who was a good guy, but not necessarily a very good manager at this time in his career, was having trouble juggling all of these catchers here. So when Coker did get in, yes, he would shine at the plate, but not necessarily behind the plate. In fact, during the 1960 season, he had allowed 55 stolen bases. That was the most in the majors. So he was not the worst catcher in the Phillies organization. They just never had really any great catchers. So the Phillies continued to stockpile catchers throughout the years. And you start seeing the writing on the wall if you're Jimmy Coker in 1961, as he was assigned to Buffalo in AAA, as Clay Dalrymple gets the starting job, but also the Phillies decide to keep Cal Neiman as well as Choo Choo Coleman, Rumor has it his wife's name was Mrs. Coleman, as Choo Choo would say, with the Mets in 1962. Anyways, you could start seeing all of these players start stacking up in front of him. And of course, the Air Force is calling him again. Of course, as you've got tensions in the Cold War ratcheting up, the Air Force Reserve Unit calls him back to duty, and that's where he spends much of the 1962 season. Finally, at the end of the 1962 season, he is picked up off waivers by the Baltimore Orioles, and Coker's thinking, great, I got a new lease on life. I don't have four or five guys in front of me. I can be a starter in Baltimore. They've got some young stars there. Things are turning around. Not so fast. In fact, only about 3 weeks after the Orioles picked him up off waivers, they trade him to the San Francisco Giants along with pitchers Jack Fisher and Billy Heft for catcher John Orsino and pitcher Stu Miller and Mike McCormick. So once again, Coker finds himself behind a lot of catchers in the Giants farm system, and he is splitting time again between the major leagues and the minor leagues. After the 1963 season, he's traded to the St. Louis Cardinals for pitcher Ken McKenzie. And once again, Coker's thinking, great, I've got a chance here. Here we go. Oops. No, right before the start of the 1964 season, he's traded along with Gary Kolb to the Milwaukee Braves for the Uke. Yes, Bob Uecker. And again, the Braves have some pretty good catchers already up at the major league level, so he ends up going to the minor leagues. Eventually, he gets moved over to the Cincinnati Reds. In fact, a cash trade here. The Reds traded him in exchange for $35,000. Of course, by this time, the Braves hurting for money before they made their move to Atlanta. So he's got one last hope here with the Cincinnati Reds, and he's basically platooning with another veteran catcher, Don Pavlotich. Now, when you've got two veteran catchers, and you've got a Reds team that in the mid to late 1960s is kind of going through a minor rebuild here, even though they had some pretty decent teams in, say, 64 and 65. You know what that means. There's somebody coming up to take your job. And that somebody just happened to be named Johnny Bench. Well, we all know how that turned out for that prospect catcher. So it turns out Coker's last big league appearance happened in September of 1967. After his playing days, he decided to buy the farm. No, quite literally, he bought a farm. He became a farmer in Throckmorton, Texas, which is outside of Fort Worth. Of course, any city not named Dallas, San Antonio, or Houston is outside of Fort Worth when you look at Texas. And he would actually become a member of the board of directors of the Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association in Throckmorton, sadly passing away in October of 1991 at the age of 56 after a heart attack. He never quite reached the Roy Campanella or best in the National League plaudits, which is rather unfortunate. But again, a lot of that has to do because they never quite really figured out how to reduce his defensive problems, but also he was seriously mismanaged in his early days in Major League Baseball with the Phillies. And that's actually not all that unusual with, you know, a lot of teams. You will find, and I can attest to this with, you know, the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, there were a lot of careers of young players that were completely derailed because the Devil Rays organization was such a mess. Now we've got another interesting card here. Bob Anderson, who is a pitcher for the Chicago Cubs, and he was one of the first pitchers who was almost designated as a reliever. He did not start that many games in his career, as brief as it was. He played just from 1957 through 1962, most of that with the Cubs. And he was a nearby Chicago kid, actually born in East Chicago, Indiana, in 1935, signed with the Cubs in 1954, very quickly moves up through their organization as he makes his major league debut in 1957. And like I said, was mostly a member of the bullpen, although occasionally became a spot starter. Now, he became a full-time starting pitcher in 1959 and managed to start more games than save them or come in relief for the final few years of his season. and eventually, you know, did move back to the bullpen starting in 1961 and eventually got traded to Detroit in 1962. And that is where his career would end after getting traded to Kansas City for Rocky Colavito. The A's decided to pair him off the minor league roster before the 1964 season started. So his career numbers read 36 and 46, earned an average of 4.26. And even though he was mostly a reliever in his career, he did end up having 15 complete games out of the handful of games that he started. Now, the one interesting note about Bob Anderson's career for pretty much a very average ball player is that he was involved in one of the most not-so-average plays in baseball history. It happened June 30th, 1959, Cubs and Cardinals at Wrigley Field. Anderson pitching, Stan Musial at the plate, 3-1 count. Anderson's pitch gets past catcher Sammy Taylor, rolls all the way to the backstop. Now, home plate umpire Vic Delmore calls it ball four. But Taylor and Anderson argue with the umpire, saying that Musial tipped the ball, so it should be a foul tip that is in play. So basically a foul tip and I guess a passed ball would be the way that you score it. Well, while this is happening, Musial thinks, well, this is ball four, because the umpire said it's ball four, I'm making my way to first base. So like any good coach tells a little leaguer, on a pass ball on ball four, you run to first base, and that's what Stan the Man does. He's running to first base, he's rounding first, and he's starting to break to second base. Well, while the argument's going on at home plate, Alvin Dark, who was playing third base for the Cubs at that time, runs back to the backstop, gets the ball, and he's ready to put it back in play. Well, while the argument's going on over whether this is ball four and if there's a live ball in play, the home plate umpire, Delmore, gets a new ball and gives it to the catcher, Taylor. And they're thinking that's a dead ball situation. Meanwhile, Anderson turns around. He sees Musial's running for a second. So Anderson grabs the ball from Taylor and throws it to the second baseman, Tony Taylor. Well, the ball was a little off target. In fact, it flies over Tony Taylor and goes into center field. Meanwhile, Alvin Dark still has the original baseball, so he throws it over to Ernie Banks, who's covering second base. Now, Musial doesn't see this. He sees the ball that Anderson threw going to center field. He thinks he's got third base. Well, there's Banks right there with the ball and glove, tags him. And strangely enough, the umpires call him out. Even though the home plate umpire issued a new ball, it seems that the infield umpires saw the original ball as the ball that was still official and thus in play. So Musial was out. I'm not exactly sure how you would score that play. So I guess it would be foul tip, pass ball, 2-1-4-8. E1, but you also have the ball, the original ball, which was picked up after the pass ball, which would then go, let's see, 5-6 for the put out on the advancer running or the runner advancing on second base. I'm not exactly sure. I can't even speak English after thinking of that play. Anyways, it didn't matter in the end. The Cardinals won the game 4-1. But that is just one of the interesting tidbits of Bob Anderson. So maybe not a career that stands out, a very average major league career, but one that certainly stands out for the extremely unusual play that he was involved with. Now, another Cubs player at that time, and he's featured with the Cubs on this card here, is Joe Schaefernoth. And this is the one player that has really the most mundane story out there. There's not a big story that goes with him, but we'll go ahead and share it because he's in this page of cards here. He was also a right-handed pitcher, mostly a reliever, played for the Cubs from 1959 to 61, and eventually got traded to the Cleveland Indians. Born in Trenton, New Jersey, a star of Jonathan Dayton High School in Springfield Township, moves up very quickly through the Cubs organization, makes the team roster out of spring training in 1959. Major league debut, scoreless inning of relief against the San Francisco Giants, and also has a rather dubious note in baseball history, as in a game against the Dodgers at the Los Angeles Coliseum, he makes his only major league start, and it's one to forget, as Schaefernoth failed to retire a batter. He surrendered 3 hits, 1 walk, and 3 earned runs before getting the hook. Thankfully, the Cubs were able to come back and win the game 8-7, so that spared him a loss. However, his earned run average for that moment in history was abysmal, to say the least. Now, because Schaefernoth was dealing with some injuries and the Cubs were going through pitchers at this time like they were dime a dozen, he would eventually end up back in Fort Worth in AAA. And that's where he pretty much split much of his remaining time with the Cubs. He would eventually get picked up on waivers by the Indians, relieved in 15 games, didn't really have a whole lot to write about there. Picked up by the Washington Senators in the offseason in a waiver transaction, but he was actually returned to Cleveland prior to the start of the 1962 season. Doesn't make the Indians roster, is actually in AAA with the Jacksonville Suns. He would be there in 1963 as well, ending up his major league career there. Passed away in 2016 at the age of 78. From cancer. I should also mention, by the way, if you're just keeping score at home too, Bob Anderson passed away as well. He is no longer around. Passed away at the age of 79 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, back in 2015. All right, let's talk about some of the more well-known players here. A gentleman who passed away, sadly, just a couple of years ago, Stretch Willie McCovey, front and center on my page of cards here. And Willie McCovey is a great story because he was actually overlooked by the same scout who signed Hank Aaron out of Mobile, Alabama, signed him to the Indianapolis Clowns of the Negro Leagues. And, of course, Mobile, Alabama, just a hotbed of incredible African-American ball players in the early 1950s. And, of course, when you're thinking of Mobile, Alabama, you think of players like Willie Mays. Well, don't forget about Willie McCovey. Willie McCovey is often overlooked because Mays gets all the attention. Of course, Hank Aaron got a lot of attention. There were a lot of great African-American players who were starting to come to prominence at this time. But Willie McCovey was definitely a force to be reckoned with. In fact, a lot of managers, Sparky Anderson said he was one of the toughest players to try to determine what you were going to do. Were you going to pitch to him? Were you going to walk him? Because he was a tremendous pull hitter, but had incredible power. Back when Candlestick Park was an open stadium before they enclosed it in 1971 to house the 49ers, McCovey was often sending moonshots over the right field seats into San Francisco Bay. And let's back it up a little bit there. Like I said, he came from Mobile, Alabama, and even though the Indianapolis Clown Scout passed on him for Hank Aaron, the New York Giants did not pass on him. They were able to sign him in 1954, and he very quickly moves up through the Giants organization and has to deal with playing in the Jim Crow era South. Throughout this time, which of course made a major impression on him. Of course, he grew up in Mobile, so that was a fact of life, but couldn't play in games when he was playing in the minor leagues, in the Texas League, prior to making his major league debut. Couldn't play in games that were in Shreveport because of Jim Crow laws that were going on at that time. So he works his way through the minor leagues and eventually makes his major league debut in July of 1959. How's this for a debut? Goes 4-for-4, 2 singles and 2 triples. But wait, he does it against Robin Roberts, just a Hall of Fame pitcher for the Phillies. That's the debut. I think people realized how good he was going to be. And like I said, he was a notorious pull hitter, had a lot of power. I've mentioned Sparky Anderson gave him all sorts of plaudits. There's a story that goes Casey Stengel, I think when he was with the Mets once, was talking to one of his pitchers and says, all right, where do you want to pitch him, upper deck or lower deck? And Bob Gibson, boy, you talk about a sign of respect. Bob Gibson said that Willie McCovey was one of the hardest outs to get, if not the hardest out to get. So when Bob Gibson says that, Bob Gibson would strike the fear of God into players Well, Willie McCovey struck the fear of God in Bob Gibson. One infamous play that McCovey was involved in, 1962 World Series Giants-Yankees Game 7, bottom of the ninth, two outs, two on, Willie Mays at second, Matt Alou at third, Giants trailing the Yankees 1-0. Who's up to bat? Willie McCovey slams a line drive that seems destined to go into right field. You're going to score Alou. You're going to send Mays at the plate. Giants could walk it off 2-1, bottom of the ninth inning, but no. Out of nowhere, Bobby Richardson, second baseman for the Yankees, leaps, snares that line drive, game over, series over. The Giants, of course, would not appear in a World Series again until 1989, would not win a World Series until 2010. So the 1962 World Series and that line drive snared by Bobby Richardson off the bat of Willie McCovey, a legend and a heartbreaker for Giants fans for many, many years, including California resident, not native. He was originally from St. Paul, Charles Schulz, creator of the Peanuts comic strip. Right after the 1962 World Series, not once but twice, lamenting about that play where Charlie Brown suggesting why couldn't McCovey have hit that ball just 3 feet higher. And, you know, McCovey, for many years, despite his great career, was still kicking himself over why couldn't I hit that ball over Bobby Richardson. So an incredible moment, but still an incredible career that would come out here over the next several years. National League MVP in 1969, and again taking advantage of the rather spacious and friendly wind shifts in Candlestick Park before it was enclosed in 1971. Of course, at the same time, too, his body's starting to break down a little bit. He's not as effective as he used to be. And the Giants are also cheap. They started going through some ownership changes and some troubles in the early to mid-70s. So after the 1973 season, the Giants trade McCovey and Bernie Williams, no, not that Bernie Williams, the other Bernie Williams, to the San Diego Padres for pitcher Mike Caldwell. So McCovey comes in and plays 128 games in 1974, 122 games in 1975, and still has over 20 home runs in each of those seasons. Now, he started wearing out again in 1976, actually loses the starting first base job to Mike Ivey, and midseason gets traded. Or not traded, rather, his contract gets purchased by the Oakland Athletics, who were looking to utilize him basically as a designated hitter, pinch hitter, during one of their last swingin' A's playoff runs in 1976. He appeared in 11 games for them. After the 1976 season, he goes back to San Francisco and also surpasses the 500 home run mark at this point in time. Also hits two home runs in one inning. And it was the second time that he did that in his career, so quite the feat there. Here in Comeback Player of the Year honors in 1977, as I mentioned, eclipsed 500 home runs. He does that in 1978. And in 1980, hits his final home run, number 521 for his career, off Scott Sanderson of the Montreal Expos at Olympic Stadium. So his career winds down after the 1980 season, 22 years, batted 270, 521 home runs, 1,555 RBI, and he also hit 18 grand slams in his career. That is a National League record, six-time All-Star as well. His number 44, which he wore in honor of fellow Mobilian Hank Aaron, retired by the Giants in 1980. And as you are probably well aware of, the watery splashdown area behind the right field fence at the Giants' new ballpark, Oracle Park, is called McCovey Cove. Now, some unfortunate news with Willie McCovey, as he and Duke Snyder pled guilty to federal tax fraud charges because he failed to report about $10,000 in income from sports card shows, memorabilia sales in the late 1980s. Now, he was given 2 years of probation, also a $5,000 fine, and received a pardon from Barack Obama in Obama's final days as president back in January of 2017. Now, he suffered from many health issues throughout the final years of his life, including AFib. He had an infection that almost killed him in 2015, had some very bad knees, was pretty much wheelchair bound the last couple of years of his life, passing away in October of 2018. Now, ironically, our last player is Edwin Duke Snyder. Yes, the player we were just talking about. Yes, they are not just connected here, Duke Snyder and Willie McCovey, because they happen to occupy the same page of baseball cards that I have. But, you know, they were also involved in that tax scheme. All right, let's go ahead and start with that. Snyder was pled guilty to federal tax fraud charges. He failed to report income of $100,000 or more. So he did not get the Barack Obama pardon. And he did, however, get a lighter sentence because he did, you know, work with the government on paying back these back taxes. And while McCovey did this over a course of, I believe it was 3 years, Snyder did this for actually several years. So he was really up to it in all sorts of illegal problems here, and he was able to work his way out of that. However, even though he did not spend any jail time because of that, even though he was heavily fined. In fact, $5,000, had to pay back $57,000 in back taxes, and also got the 2 years probation, even though he got a lighter sentence. His reputation was damaged. And that's not to say that Duke Snyder had that great of a reputation to begin with. Of course, Duke Snyder is much loved because he was one of the members of that 1955 Brooklyn Dodger World Champion team. But as many people would allude to in later years, he was a spoiled brat. Now, perhaps it's because he was an only child born to Ward and Florence Snyder in September 1926 outside of Los Angeles, California. Duke was given that nickname by his father, so there was a little air of supremacy from a very early day. Duke Snyder was a multi-talented star, not only a great baseball player, but he was also a basketball player at Compton High School, and one of his teammates, Pete Rozelle, who of course would become the legendary commissioner of the NFL in the 1960s. And speaking of football, Snyder was also a star quarterback, allegedly could throw touchdown passes at 60, 70 yards distance. And of course, he was the cleanup hitter for his high school baseball team and was a pitcher as well. He had an outstanding arm, great bat, had a very big problem of being streaky at the plate. When he went dry at the plate, Duke Snyder was in a drought. But there were so many superlatives to Duke's game, mainly the power of his arm. When he could grab a hold of a pitch, he could clobber it. But also, he was a guy that, those parts of his game helped overlook his moodiness, his droughts, some of the run-ins that he had with managers. Now, he was scouted by one of Branch Rickey's scouts in 1944, coming out of high school. Really liked his speed, the power in his arm, of course, and the power at his bat. Moves up through the Dodgers organization rather quickly, makes his major league debut in the Dodgers' second game of the 1947 season. That's also when Jackie Robinson got his first major league hit. So naturally, Duke and Jackie were very close for a long time while they were with the Dodgers. And in fact, when a lot of Jackie's teammates early on were trying to petition him off the team, Duke was one of the first to say no. So he was one of the first allies for Jackie Robinson in those early days. Now, of course, you know that the history of Duke Snyder with the Brooklyn Dodgers would become a force with the bat, could launch some moonshots, but like I said, could be very moody. He often felt that he was shunned, whether it was by the media or by the teammates or by management. He once demanded a trade from the Dodgers. Dodgers management said, no, we're not going to let that happen. Even Pee Wee Reese, the undisputed leader of the Dodgers teams, finally, you know, had to crack the whip on Duke, basically saying, you know, get your crap together here. So Walt Alston, and of course, previous managers too. Yeah, you had Leo DeRocher and many others just kind of dealt with the ups and downs that Duke had. And there were plenty of run-ins with Walt Alston and Duke Snyder. And one way to get production out of Duke was to bench him or scratch him from the lineup. He would come back extremely angry, and he would show everybody by hitting a key home run or some situation like that. Now, not only was he moody, but he was also somewhat lazy in the outfield. So he did not always hustle after ground balls. Even though he had a great arm, he didn't exactly have his head in the game all the time, much to the chagrin of managers and teammates. And they were often flummoxed by Duke Snyder because Duke had a pretty decent personality with fans, but he also turned on them. He booed them. In fact, Duke Snyder called out Brooklyn Dodger fans in 1955, and they let the Duke have it. They really did. But also, Duke Snyder, you know, had to, you know, deal with his own inner demons. He was just a very surly guy despite this incredible talent. Well, he would follow the Dodgers out to Los Angeles. Again, he was an LA native, so he didn't mind the move. And of course, he was one of the first stars of the Los Angeles Dodgers. He is the only player to hit a home run over the right center field fence in the 1958 season. And he became the household hero. He was the highest paid player. And despite dealing with some knee issues, the fans in Los Angeles absolutely loved him. But fans in New York did as well when the Dodgers would come back to play the new Mets in 1962. Duke was greeted with all sorts of fanfare from the fans during batting practice. And, you know, a lot of fans really loved him. Well, in the 1962 season, which, as I mentioned, the Giants won the pennant that year, well, the Dodgers were actually maintaining a lead in that pennant run in 1962. And Duke was one of the most outspoken critics of Walt Alston and some of Alston's choices for pitching matchups and other things. So finally, after the 1962 season, with a logjam in the outfield, Duke's injuries, and again his surliness, the Dodgers decided to basically give up on him, and they traded him to the Mets. Now, Snyder was actually going to consider retiring, but the Dodgers actually convinced him to continue to play with the Mets, and it turned out to be a win-win situation, even though he was not very good at the plate anymore. In fact, he hit just .278 and 5 home runs. Hard to hit some home runs, you know, unless you're pulling down the line in the old Polo Grounds. So, yeah, he was still a huge fan favorite. And, you know, the 1963 Mets needed anything to pull player or pull fans in because they were such a terrible team. So he was much loved by the Mets in 1963. Now, a lot of people don't know this. Snyder actually ended his career with the Giants in 1964. Basically, the Mets not wanting to, you know, basically bring him back, and likewise Duke didn't want to play for a 100-plus loss team. He wanted to play for a contender, so the Mets were able to move him to the Giants, convince him to actually play for the Giants after playing for the Dodgers for so many years. Duke took the opportunity. The Giants were somewhat of a contending team, and of course San Francisco not too far from his roots in Los Angeles. Now, he would hit just .210 in 167 at-bats, hit the final 4 home runs in his career, and hung him up for good in 1964. Became an avocado rancher for several years after his major league career, and then got into broadcasting after some stints as a scout and a manager in the Dodgers minor league system. He would become a broadcaster with the San Diego Padres. Of course, former Dodger GM Buzzy Bavasi was the GM in San Diego those early years. Was also a batting instructor for the Padres in the early days. And when the Padres started experiencing some front office troubles, he moved on wisely to the Montreal Expos, again becoming a part-time batting instructor and a broadcaster. In fact, he was a broadcaster for the team well into the mid-1980s. He retired from the booth after the 1986 season, suffered a heart attack in 1987, and would continue to have medical issues throughout the remainder of his life. Not only heart issues, but also struggling with weight gain, had diabetes, and also numerous knee surgeries, much like Willie McCovey. Much like McCovey, too, after dealing with numerous injuries and health issues, decided to kind of wind things down, and then sadly passed away in California in February of 2011. So despite the tarnished image of Duke Snyder because of the tax fraud issues, much like Willie McCovey in the late 1990s, and despite the surliness, which a lot of fans don't know about or they conveniently forget because he was part of those legendary, lionized Brooklyn Dodgers teams in the 1950s. Despite that, a lot of fans have a lot of heartfelt memories of the Duke. And of course, and I think I've mentioned Duke Snyder before in this podcast, I'm a big fan of the Duke Snyder story because my dad was a big fan of Duke Snyder. And, you know, we did talk about Duke, I think, in the podcast that I dedicated to my father shortly after he passed in May of 2019. So there we go. The five cards of the eight that we can talk about, because we already talked Ted Bowesfield, and we have team cards for the other two. So there's our look at 61 Tops. Again, a set that, you know, we can sit here and we say was good but not great. But again, that's okay. If it's good but not great, it's not bad. It's actually a very outstanding set. Maybe if the design, the aesthetics lack a little pizzazz. You've got great stars, great rookies, and of course, 1961, a seminal season in Major League Baseball, not just the beginning of the expansion of Major League Baseball, but of course, the trials and travails and travels of the M&M boys, Mantle and Maris. Well, that'll do it for our look at 61 Tops. Again, thank you for joining me here on Wax Ecstatic. Don't forget to join us online on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. That's our handle. You can make a cash donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic, or you can make a cardboard donation. Again, email me first with your plans, mattsalmonsez@gmail.com. We'll be coming back here Friday, October 9th. We'll be taking a look at the 1993 Classic Best Minor League Baseball cards. We'll open up some packs and kind of look back at how the fun minor leagues was bastardized by the trading card industry in 1993 and by Major League Baseball. Nowadays, it's happening. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.